on candidates because few believed in the fairness of the election. In 2008, European observers said Sarkeesian's victory largely met international standards. Nonetheless, violent clashes between police and the opposition followed that vote, and authorities are on alert, despite predictions that things will be calmer this time around. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
It's been 10 years since a fire at a Rhode Island nightclub killed 100 people. Relatives turned out yesterday in bitter cold weather in West Warwick to remember those who died. The actual anniversary is on Wednesday. The names of those killed in the fire were read along with 100 seconds of silence. The design of a permanent memorial was also unveiled yesterday. Supporters say it'll take a year or two to build that. The 2003 fire was sparked by pyrotechnics during a performance by the band Great White. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering a diagnostic exam and treatment plan for advanced stage patients seeking a second opinion at cancercenter.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Each month on this program, we dedicate an hour to your health and the health of your loved ones. In recent months, we've alternated between women's health, men's health, and children's health, and we have come back around to women's health again today. And so we are pleased to welcome back Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist on the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and she does stop by every few months to talk about recent developments in her field and to answer your questions. On past programs, we've covered a wide range of subjects, everything from family planning and pregnancy to birthing and breastfeeding to osteoporosis and menopause, and we welcome any and all questions related to those and other subjects. And today, in addition to your questions, we'll explore some topics ranging from breast exams to human papillomavirus to endometriosis and beyond. As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on our Facebook or Twitter pages. We are at Focus 580. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Suzanne Truppen, welcome back to Focus.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you with us. There's a lot that we could talk about this morning.
There's been a lot in the news on women's health.
There
pretty much always is.
and understandably so. Why don't we start with HPV? What is human papillomavirus?
So human papillomavirus, there are probably somewhere between 100 and 200 different subtypes, depending on which researcher you talk to. But there are about 16 or 18 significant, what we call the high-risk viruses, the viruses that can actually cause the cancer of the cervix, cancer of the whole lower genital tract, the vagina, the vulva, the urethra, the anal regions. It can cause penile cancer in men as well. And so this is why we've been so concerned. HPV, each different type has a number.
Mm-hmm.
And HPV 16 and 18 have been determined to be the most high-risk types. And the COBUS test, which was developed to from Roche Laboratories to detect 16 and 18, focused on that concept, being that those two together probably are responsible for 80% of the cervical cancers. So we think it's important to avoid HPV infection.
Sure.
If you can.
Right.
But given that it is so ubiquitous, probably present in 40 million Americans, we want to detect who has the HPV virus. And then once we detect it, to determine if the HPV virus has now progressed on to causing the precancerous changes that can evolve into cancer.
When you say 40 million Americans have HPV or have some strain of it somewhere in their system, how do we actually know that figure? Is that a best estimate, or is it a question of that's what we feel confident the number is likely to be, but it could be higher.
So we have to get very technical when we start talking about those questions. So, yes, there is some estimation going on. Also, we're going on certain assumptions that we can resolve our infections, or we might have actually a bigger number. We also are getting better and better testing out there. So the numbers are growing because we are getting better testing and more people are getting tested. And in addition, we are now just in this transition phase of some people being treated with prevention. So going forward, those numbers may have play. There are tests for women, but the tests that we use are essentially Q-tip type tests, mm-hmm. done essentially on pap smears of the cervix. So other than in research trials like the ones that I participate in, we're not necessarily culturing the whole genital tract, and we're not necessarily testing men.
So this virus could exist in other places, and we're not necessarily
catching them all. The virus does exist in other places. We know, for instance, we've talked about this before, that it can cause oral cancers and respiratory tract disease. So we do know that it is in other places, but we don't have a good handle on that. The other way we can detect whether or not a individual has human papillomavirus is by whether or not they develop immunity. The medical term is seroconversion, whether or not they actually have a blood test showing that they have HPV virus. Not a blood test you can show up at your doctor's office and get. Again, only something that is used on research basis.
And this kind of gets closer to, you know, what's happening in the news right now. We have there's an HPV vaccine, right?
Yes.
And how effective is it?
Well, it's completely effective for HPV 16 and 18 prevention should you get it at the time prior to when you might have gotten exposed to that. So vaccination age is 9 to 12. Vaccination catch-up age is 12 to 26. Vaccination after the age of 26 is effective, but not so effective that the FDA has deemed that it should be a widespread something that's offered to patients.
The question I have, and as I'm reading up on this, is whether the fact that once you are vaccinated from it, you're in essence protected from it, but that doesn't keep you from carrying it to somebody else, right?
No, wrong. If you're protected from ever getting that infection, you will never pass it on. You will not get it. The problem is that many people have gotten vaccinated after they've already acquired the infection. So if you got vaccinated past about age 9, 10, 11, you might have already gotten exposed to the vaccine. Obviously, sexual intercourse is the most common way that people get exposed. Some amount of other kinds of genital and hand touching can expose you to the virus, which is why we know that some people test positive before the vaccine. And there are better vaccines coming because, like I said, 16 and 18 responsible for about 80% of HPV disease, but we have these other maybe 14 different types of HPV that can cause disease. And we're very carefully tracking with these large studies. One study I was in enrolled 49,000 women from around the world. The new study that we have coming up is going to enroll 47,000 women from around the world. The new data that's getting published out of these studies that are being done, very exciting, teaching us things all the time. The first study followed people out for over 3 years. So we're going to get a lot of really good information about what happens over time, what is going on with these other types. As we start to see bigger groups of patients vaccinated against 16 and 18, are we going to see emergence of other viral types? Are we going to see the protection against other viral types we suspect may come from cross-immunity? There are a lot of unanswered questions. It's pretty exciting.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions today on women's health for Dr. Suzanne Troopen, an obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She's also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She drops by from time to time to field a wide range of questions about women's health, everything from family planning and pregnancy to birthing and breastfeeding to osteoporosis, menopause, and beyond. You can call us with your questions at 333-9455. or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also post questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. Let's move on to breast cancer and breast exams. How often should women do self-checks for breast cancer?
Breast cancer is a common disease in the United States. We think that one in eight women will get breast cancer before they die. So anything we can do to proactively prevent breast cancer or detect it early is important. So when we use mammograms, there have been good research studies to show that mammograms will detect earlier cancers and will prevent deaths. Now, what cost mammograms are, because they detect a lot of non-cancerous disease as well, we can talk about. One thing that's been a little less clear is a regular breast self-exam. There's no doubt about it. If you feel, when you're bathing, if you feel something abnormal, if you detect in touching yourself or examining yourself an actual lump, then that's very important to bring to the attention of your healthcare provider, because women detect a significant percentage of their own actual breast cancers that present as lumps. Now, a mammogram can detect that 2 years before it ever becomes an actual lump. The name even a doctor can feel, and maybe 4 years before you're feeling something. So it's less clear what you can do on a regular basis of breast exams. So for a long time, we taught women once a month. Do it at the first day of the month, something like that. But once a month, once you're old enough to be taught, check your own breasts and let us know. The problem with that system is that women, although well-educated and have a good system of checking their breasts, may find lumps that aren't suspicious, that will be very transient, that shouldn't necessarily undergo extensive medical testing. So for women doing regular self-breast exams, the studies show they might pick up a few more cancers, but the flip side is they're going to pick up many, many, many non-cancers that they have to chase down.
And this gets to the heart of something that I think women and men, you know, everyone can kind of understand, which is, you know, there are always those moments where, like, you know, maybe you touch your neck and you're like, what the heck is that? You know, there are little imperfections in all of our bodies that from time to time present themselves, and most of them are nothing. So how do you know the difference between something that's nothing and something that's something?
Well, of course, it depends on the spot that you find, exactly what you're feeling, whether or not you have any associated symptoms, whether or not you have risk factors. Have you been told that you're at risk to develop this spot on your neck that maybe you found? And I think that's where we're moving medicine to be more cost effective. Really get on top of the people with the most risk. Do whatever you can to reduce the risk. And then get the information out there to help you make that decision, so that a little bit of Googling's probably good for you. A lot of Googling's probably bad for you. Like anything else in life, too much of a good thing can be bad. So sometimes we see people who've done all this research and they've gone beyond, what should I do about this little neck spot? Now they're
You could find yourself, you cough a couple of times, go to WebMD or one of those sites, and before you've finished with their symptom tracker, think, oh my God, I have 500 diseases.
Well, exactly. And I think the physicians then are loath to know which direction to start looking, because that needle is hard to find in a haystack. And so definitely we tell women lumps that are very hard, lumps that are persistent throughout a medical menstrual cycle are more significant. Anything that's accompanied with new breast discharge or lumpiness under your arm or in your neck, those kinds of signs and symptoms, skin changes, heat to that area, those kinds of signs and symptoms are important to report to your physician. And I think with breast lumps, they're good lists out there of what, in addition to just finding a lump, might be a sign that you need to go talk to your physician about. When it comes to cancers, cancers start as a single cell. With breast cancer, until it becomes detectable on mammogram, it's probably been in your body as that single cell multiplying for 8 to 10 years. By the time a physician can feel it, it's more in the 10 to 12. And by the time it's a big mass that anybody could feel, it could have been in your body in that 10 to 14 year time span. So that's a good thing in that it's slow. We have a chance to detect that disease when it is still in the extremely curable range. But on the flip side, you can also go too far in trying to get those cancers early, and now you're detecting things that really won't go on in those next 6 to 8 years to harm your life.
Let me ask you a question that, depending on your answer, will either set lots of minds at ease or freak people out. But I'm curious about this. When, you know, patients come in and say, well, I've detected what I believe may be a lump or something. Can you give me sort of a ballpark of the – I imagine that's a conversation you have constantly. Somebody says, well, I think there's a thing here. Is this a thing? Is it not? How often when somebody comes in, does it turn out to actually be something significant, you know, potentially breast cancer, something that must be dealt with right away, versus how often it's your response is, oh, that's nothing to worry about it?
And again, it depends on who you are.
Yeah.
If you're 60 years old and you have a strong family history of breast cancer, maybe you were even a smoker, maybe you are on high-dose hormone therapy, well, I'm going to tell you this is a much more worrisome concern. If you're 30 and you just finished breastfeeding your baby and no one in your family has ever had breast cancer and you're a healthy young lady, the chances that this is going to be a breast cancer is extremely small. So, but we never tell anybody that the chance is 100% or zero.
Right.
It's always going to be in the middle. And fortunately, we have lots of good ways of determining what it is.
To that end, we've been talking about self-checks, but how often should women get mammograms?
So, it depends on who you are. Most medical organizations endorse your first mammogram being at age 40 or 10 years prior to a close family member having had breast cancer. There's the U.S. Preventive Task Force and what they do in many other countries that have similar population stars, which they don't actually begin screening until age 50. Once you get that first mammogram, then you have to decide how often. Is it going to be every year? Is it going to be every other year? And when are you going to stop having mammograms? Some organizations would say you can stop after age 75. Other organizations point out that if you're young enough in your physical self and that you are detected with a very treatable condition, that the treatment could be well withstood by you and your good health, then it's worth, if you're going to be able to act on that mammogram, keep getting them.
This seems like one of those subjects that the conventional wisdom is always shifting a little bit. Is that right? Am I perceiving correctly that there's not only some ongoing debate in the medical community about how often and what sorts of mammograms you should get, that you know, if we sit down 5 years from now, we may have a completely different conversation about what to do?
So, again, it depends on what's going on 5 years from now. Have we reduced our smoking? Have we reduced our postmenopausal hormone therapy use? What's going on with obesity in the United States? What's going on with the fat consumption, whether or not you're obese? There are so many factors. What have we discovered in terms of new genes? We have the breast cancer 1 and 2 test that we can get. And if you get that blood test and you're positive, again, you're in your own group. But there are other genes that can be disordered that can lead to increased risk of breast cancer. And if we know about those people are going to get into that other group. What about cancer research and funding? Are we going to have a couple of new studies to really lay out what's going on? How about testing? Are we going to have a blood test that can detect breast cancers. I'll put a parenthesis, probably not. But are we going to have better ultrasounds where there's no radiation risk to getting the test? So unfortunately, our crystal ball is just not focused enough to be able to say what we're going to say. So when we say conventional wisdom, what the patients mean is, what's everybody know out there? But what the doctors mean is, what tests are out there and how can I best apply that medical research to you, my individual patient that I'm taking care of today? And that's going to be a little bit different than just, well, as a general recommendation, people should do this or that. But between you and me, as your recommendation, this is what I think is best for you. And we may be moving away. You know, I feel like as a private practitioner, you get me as your doctor. You don't get a protocol. You don't get a clinic. You don't get a group. You get me. But I know that we're moving away from that system a little bit. So that has some benefits. It may have some negatives in terms of being able to individually apply information to a patient's very thorough case.
You mentioned smoking. I want to get back to that subject in just a minute. A reminder, though, you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopen, an obstetrician and gynecologist on the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Medicine. She stops by every few months to talk about recent developments in her field and to answer your questions on women's health. On past programs, we've covered all sorts of subjects, everything from family planning and pregnancy to birthing and breastfeeding to osteoporosis and menopause. We welcome most any women's health question you may have at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus 580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Really, anything you might discuss with your own OBGYN is certainly welcome today. So I hope you will give us a call and avail yourself of this opportunity to talk with Dr. Troopen. As I'm doing right now, and I want to move on to smoking. There are some recent studies out indicating that women are at a much higher risk for developing heart problems if they smoke than previously thought, that there might also be some payoffs for quitting smoking before the age of 40 specifically. What do you say to patients who smoke, if anything other than, you know, you really ought to quit?
So we want to help our patients quit. We want to prevent our patients from starting to smoke. If we could eliminate cigarettes being sold out there, I think that would go a long way to making it easier on all of us. Smoking is not healthy for women or men. In women, smoking increases your risk of cancers. It increases your risk of problem pregnancies. It gives you dental disease. We can go on and on and on. And yes, it is an increased risk for heart disease. Women in the United States today have a significant amount of atherosclerosis. So we need oxygen to our blood vessels, to our organs. And our blood vessels, including those of the heart, will bring that oxygen to our organs. But the more constricted those blood vessels are due to higher blood pressure or things like nicotine, which can send your blood pressure up, or the more constricted they are due to atherosclerosis, a process of forming plaques in those blood vessels, the less oxygen you're going to bring to organs. This is why with our tiny little blood vessels, we don't have the same heart disease symptoms as men. And this is why with a normal cholesterol test, just, you know, speaking of false negative tests, cholesterol is not the problem that causes atherosclerosis. It's part of the problem, but it's the blood vessel wall inflammation, the fact that we have smaller blood vessels, how high is your blood pressure, whether you have the kinds of cholesterol particles that are more likely to land in your blood vessel wall and therefore become oxidized and so forth. So we have all these different factors that we have to take into consideration. So in women, 50 years ago, they barely smoked. They snuck a cigarette behind a building or something, but they weren't smokers. Now we have smokers that are women like men. They smoke about the same. They start early and they smoke about the same amount. but we're physically smaller people with smaller lungs, smaller blood vessels, and these other factors that impact on whether or not we are going to get the heart and lung disease that smoking can produce. So yes, the less you smoke, the better you are. And the younger you quit, it seems to be also better, whether that's hormonal or age plaque related or some other cofactor about being female, we're not exactly sure.
Are there other instances you can think of where the way women's bodies work that is different from the way men's bodies work is impacted by outside forces like smoking? I mean, you know, and let's take alcohol consumption. Is there something physiologically so different about women than men that really should impact the way women think about consuming alcohol?
Well, yes. In fact, because alcohol is a factor in terms of breast cancer, we have bigger breasts. So we have we need less to get a breast cancer than a man because they have breast tissue, but just not as much. So probably if you did the math, that's one of the factors. Also, we have other things that will impact our liver. So we have more migraine disease. We probably take more things like Tylenol. We take hormone therapy to control our menstrual cycles and to control our bodies in terms of contraception. So some of these factors probably impact on how we metabolize alcohol in our liver. And yes, those are all factors. Our levels, we have estrogen, you have testosterone. We quit having estrogen by the age of 40s to early 50s, you keep making your testosterone a lot longer. Then we get a little bit of a shift. We go from this estrogen dominant state to a more testosterone dominant state. Our testosterone levels never get to the male levels, but our testosterone becomes much higher in dosage than our estrogen as we age. This is why as we age, we're doing more laser hair removal in our office. Women get that Adam's apple, they get the deep voice, they get the little saggy throat and a little bit of hair because they're becoming more testosterone dominant than they used to be when they were younger. So there are quite a few physiologic changes that then have lots of impact. So sports injury, we have a different pelvis. So we can be playing basketball with guys. We're going to get many more ACL, MCL, PCL injuries of our knees because we have a different angle of carriage between that different pelvis down to where our knee is. So there are, it's not just our hormones, it's how we are actually built.
Among the many things you just cited, you mentioned that women get more migraines. Is that right, than men?
We think so.
Why?
Again, hormones and in pregnancy, migraines can be worsened and maybe more sensitive to stress. We don't know all the reasons, but they do.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. It's our regular conversation about women's health on today's program. My guest is obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Suzanne Truppen from Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She's also on the faculty of the University of Illinois College of Medicine, and she is here to field your questions on a wide range of women's health subjects, from breast exams and birth control to osteoporosis and menopause. Really, anything that you might discuss with your own doctor is welcome at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. And we will have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Hello, I'm John Steinbacher, Membership Director at Illinois Public Media. As a regular WILL radio listener, you are no doubt aware that we often use in-program pledge interruptions to request your support. But many of you have asked if we could possibly maybe sort of just do this a little bit less. So starting this Wednesday, February 20th, we hope to raise $40,000 in 4 days with minimal interruptions. Go to will.illinois.edu/clear the air for more information.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble, presenting their next concert for winds, brass, and percussion on Sunday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m. at Holy Cross Church in Champaign. The program features Handel's Music for the Royal Fireworks and Stravinsky's Mass with special guests Prairie Voices. Details are at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We are talking today with Dr. Suzanne Truppen. For many years, Dr. Truppen has joined us on this program on a regular basis to field your questions about women's health. Everything from family planning and pregnancy to birthing and breastfeeding to osteoporosis, menopause, and beyond. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Another subject that you wanted to raise today was endometriosis. What is endometriosis?
So endometriosis is the presence of endometrial glands outside the uterus. The endometrium is the lining of the uterus. And if that tissue is now growing outside the uterus, behind the uterus, within the wall of the abdomen, on the ovary, or more distant sites, it's termed endometriosis. It's a significant problem. It may occur in 5 to 10% of all women, and it can produce chronic pelvic pain and infertility.
What are the typical treatments for it?
Well, the treatments have all been hormonal and surgery. And one of the hormonal treatments can be pregnancy, but that's a hard pill to prescribe.
Right.
But the levels of progesterone produced by the placenta in pregnancy have been known to be high enough to control endometriosis. But anything that damps down the cycle changes of that tissue, whether it's living inside the uterus or outside of the uterus, is something that can treat endometriosis. And we're calling it more of a syndrome than a disease now. And that is crucial because we've traditionally relied on surgery to make that diagnosis, and we're trying to make that firm diagnosis, and we're trying to move into an era where we're understanding more the whole spectrum of the disease. So it's not just pelvic pain, but it could be menstrual cramps or pain with intercourse or other kinds of symptoms. So we're really trying to understand the syndrome, and that's where a lot of the research has been. And also we're trying to take the treatments beyond the ovary. So the strategy has always been, okay, women have the most estrogen production out of the ovary. Let's shut that ovarian estrogen production down. And that is partially and very effective in the treatment of endometriosis, but we make estrogen in other parts of our body, our fat, our brain, our adrenal gland. And if we can have hormonal strategies that reduce estrogen production elsewhere, we might have a better fighting chance of getting a cure with medicine. And that's the direction all the research is going.
Let's talk in a few minutes a little bit more about amounts of estrogen and what impact that has. But first, let's take a call. We have Carol on the line from Champaign. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Dr. Truppen, I'm concerned about my husband and pipe smoking. He smokes a pipe every night. Occasionally, there's my children in the room, and occasionally I am in the room. How dangerous is it, secondhand smoke?
It's so hard to tease out the data on secondhand smoke because it's, you know, obviously going to be very different if you are sitting right next to him versus in a very big room. Maybe he's next to a window. Maybe there's a fan, so forth and so on. Pipes in particular can be packed very densely. So the amount of the tars and nicotines and the different substances that you would be exposed to from one pipe smoker to the next might be very, very different. And so it's been argued. We know that secondhand smoke is a lot less dangerous than being the smoker. But what the newest research has shown is that the cigarettes have an ability to impact changes on the cellular level extremely rapidly. And that's why we think that we'll see, for instance, people quit smoking in their early 20s, but die of lung cancer in their 40s or 50s, and these odd cases that we all hear about. So if somebody's already had some of those DNA changes induced in their cells from, say, being a smoker at some point in their life, is secondary smoke now more dangerous? It's hard to say. One thing we can say is that secondary smoke has been drastically reduced in the past couple of years. So you don't smoke, you don't really get exposed to smoke in restaurants, airports, so forth. You know, whole hospital campuses, parking lots included, are supposed to be smoke-free now. So we get exposed so much less. I think that'll be our answer. We'll be able to look forward in the next 5 to 10 years and say, you know, we all got a lot less secondary smoke exposure. Are we seeing a natural reduction in some disease? It may be too little of a blip to compare it to all the smokers we still have, but that's what we're thinking. We'll really be able to tell us epidemiologically the answer to what you want to know.
So is pipe smoking thought to be less dangerous, secondhand pipe smoking, to cigarette smoking?
You were saying is the heart of the matter. He has one pipe, whereas some people have been exposed to secondhand smoke. To chain smokers, or smokers out there consuming 4 packages of cigarettes a day, you do the math in the evening, you know, kids were getting exposed to more than one package of cigarettes of secondary smoke. That's a massive amount of smoke in a small room. And, you know, lately we've all been insulating our houses, so we pay less in heating bills, and so we have less escape from toxins of all kinds, not just cigarette smoke. So these are complicated questions. Also, we were talking about HPV and oral cancers, and we know that there are cofactors that make one smoker get the oral cancer and not the other, and or one person with HPV and not the other, and the smoke might be one of those factors. So the physicians have to weigh in anti-tobacco every time, no matter what shape or form.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call.
All right. Bye-bye.
And this is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. There is still time for your women's health questions for Dr. Suzanne Troopen at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us with a question at will-talk@illinois.edu. Those phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I mentioned earlier you were talking about estrogen. How do you know if, you know, as you know, a woman, if your body is producing too much or too little, what are some of the things that make that clear, that there's some sort of imbalance?
So we have certain types of women that are what we call hypoestrogenemic, and we have certain types of women that are hyperestrogenemic. If you just wanted to do a gross generalization, you'd say on average a very thin woman is hypoestrogenemic, whereas much heavier woman has too high of an estrogen. But there are many factors that do factor into this. Medication use factors into your overall estrogen status. Whether you eat meat, we get exposed to certain numbers of hormones, in particularly red meat, because of the hormones that are found in beef. But in general, it varies. There can be some very thin people that have too high of an estrogen, and vice versa.
Are there particular health risks associated with those kinds of imbalances?
Well, there are. We think that those women that are very, very low in estrogen might be predisposed to having weaker bones develop, less overall bone mass. They may have other dysfunctions. We've even seen certain amounts of heart disease. It depends on whether their low estrogen's also accompanied by abnormally low body fat. When we get into the higher estrogen states, it could be anything from a heavy menstrual period all the way to polycystic disease, to something called metabolic syndrome, where people are at risk for diabetes, heart disease, high cholesterol, and the consequences of those conditions, strokes and heart attacks.
Are there any new developments in birth control we should talk about today?
So we think that birth control is an effective way of overall promotion of health. Both it's cost effective, it has many non-contraceptive benefits, and that a planned pregnancy is the most healthy pregnancy that we have. So birth control is very important, yet we still have a high rate of unplanned pregnancies in the United States. And many of those unplanned pregnancies perhaps enter prenatal care not in the optimal health state. So you want to try to enter your pregnancy in an optimal health state. And to that end, contraception is extremely important. We think that contraception that is forgettable is the most effective. So as you get older, you're done having your children, getting Esure inserts, little coils, inserted into your fallopian tubes, 10-minute office procedure. You can watch it on television being done if you're the comfy one. That's a very effective form of birth control. When you still desire more children, something that you don't have to do health behaviors for all the time is critical. So something like an intrauterine device, the Paragard device can be inserted in the uterus and stay for 10 years. So it's done. You don't have to think about anything after for those full 10 years. The Mirena IUD is a medicated IUD that can stay in your body for 5 years. And the Mirena IUD that is approved for 5 years also is approved for heavy menstrual bleeding. So it's a good strategy for heavy menstrual bleeding for people who still want more children. If you don't want more children, a same-day office procedure like the NovaSure that can be performed will handle heavy menstrual bleeding without necessarily needing new IUDs every 5 years and so forth. Now, a new device has just been released, the Skyla device. It is related to the Mirena device, very slightly smaller, very slightly less hormone. It has levonorgestrel, which is a commonly prescribed progesterone in many of the commonly available birth control pills, and it will provide 3 years of contraceptive effectiveness, so not as much of a commitment, and being smaller has advantages for the very young and the slightly older. So that is probably the newest thing out there, the Esure being relatively unheard of for some people. Also, the Implanon device has been improved in terms of its insertion. It's the same device, but we do call it the Nexplanon because it's inserted a much easier way. And that is a progesterone-only contraceptive that is in a rod that you can put it under your skin, and it stays for 3 years. So we definitely have choices. And in the United States, the big news are the changes that have come in funding for contraception with Obamacare, the Mirena IUD. For instance, if you have both Blue Cross and Blue Cross as your plan for your medications.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield.
Blue Cross, Blue Shield. Yeah. For both your plan and your medications, I would say today you probably have 100% coverage on your Mirena other than, say, an office copay you may still have. Same with the Esure. Same with this NovaSure treatment. Same day office procedure. Office copay. So things are dramatically changing. So instead of a $1,500 Mirena with, you know, going all towards your out-of-pocket deductible, many people are having 100% coverage for their contraception. So that's probably the biggest news.
What do you say about IUDs for women who haven't had children?
So again, we will give our patients fairly long laundry lists of risks and benefits that we have to consider on an individual basis. But for most people, whether they've had children or not, there is an IUD they can safely use.
What question should you ask your doctor, or should your doctor ask you before determining if you should use one of these IUDs?
Well, again, What are your desires? How old are you? Are you using this for medical purposes to control a menstrual period? Are you sexually active? How are you going to protect yourself against sexually transmitted diseases? How soon do you plan to have children? Do you ever plan to have children? Or are you planning to have more children? Those are the kinds of things. How many sexual partners do you have? Are you low risk or relatively higher risk for sexually transmitted diseases? It's also important to make sure you don't have an undiagnosed sexually transmitted disease. Chlamydia and gonorrhea, about 3/4 of those infections might be what we call asymptomatic. You have to be tested.
What impact do those have then on whether or not you use this IUD?
You have to insert the IUD through the cervix. So inserting an IUD at the time of an active infection could cause that localized asymptomatic infection to be spread upwards into the canal of the cervix, into the uterine lining, and down the fallopian tubes into the abdomen. So a small asymptomatic infection could become an entire pelvic inflammatory disease.
Gotcha. I was reading about a survey published last fall which indicated a not insignificant percentage of healthcare providers expressing, and this is providers expressing, confusion over which women can receive IUDs. Does that surprise you at all, or why do you think that may be the case?
Well, I think that, again, when you say providers, are we talking board-certified obstetrician gynecologists, or are we talking, say, an older internist that may or may not be prescribing contraception on a regular basis? So I think those kinds of surveys do capture in a wide variety of individuals they're calling providers. I also think that there is confusion because there were different types of IUDs out in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and there were different recommendations before the research had really been done to show safety. Also, IUDs were invented prior to a test for chlamydia. When I was in medical school, we didn't even have the word chlamydia. We were taught that there's a disease out there called non-gonococcal disease. We knew it was not gonorrhea because these people were sick, but they didn't test positive for gonorrhea. But we hadn't invented the test or the diagnosis or the understanding of the chlamydia organism. So I think there's a lot of mixing of apples and oranges. There has been a change in recommendations. I also think that in the United States, we get a lot of confusion between commercials that are aimed at the malpractice aspect of medicine, and there's some media out there that gets a little bit confused. And also, I think that some of the devices have changed as well. I mean, we've only had a medicated IUD for a while, and that changes the cervical mucus. And one of the reasons that device is so amazing is because that change of cervical mucus not only prevents sperm from entering, but it prevents sperm from carrying bacteria higher up into the genital tract. So you actually, even with that IUD compared to a non-medicated one, will have a little bit less pelvic inflammatory disease.
We have about 6-7 minutes left, so there is still time. If you would like to call and ask a question of Dr. Suzanne Truppen, you can reach us right now at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or send your email to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do have an email from Marie Pierre, who asks, speaking of fibroids, when should they be removed? What are the risks? And ask a question about robotic surgery.
So uterine fibroids are a muscle knot. They're virtually never cancerous. About 1 in 30,000 are cancerous. So we've generally had the rules of pain, with the terminology of pain extending to discomforts, bladder symptoms, so forth, pain, size, or bleeding as the reasons that most women should, at that point, start thinking about treatments for uterine fibroids. And the treatments can vary very dramatically. If it's a small fibroid within the cavity of the uterus, again, office hysteroscopy, awake, shaving out that fibroid, perhaps with the new device MyoSure, that's an in-and-out office procedure, and nothing else has to happen. When it comes to a woman who has extraordinarily large fibroids, ones that, and she's done with her childbearing, and maybe these fibroids are causing pain and other problems, that woman probably is a candidate for hysterectomy. If that hysterectomy can be done laparoscopically, whether the laparoscopic instruments are controlled by a human or controlled by a human at a console, the surgeries are virtually identical. If the fibroids get too big for laparoscopic surgery, it may be safer, easier, faster to have an open procedure. And that's usually a case-by-case decided by our physician. There's this middle ground where some people are performing myomectomies by other ways. Myomectomy means retaining the uterus, getting rid of the fibroid, or getting rid of the fibroid that are on outside. Technically, the inside surgery is a myomectomy, but getting rid of bigger fibroids on the outside. That can be done with uterine artery embolization, no surgery at all, but that's a procedure for people that are done having children. It can be done medically, shrinking down the fibroids, but again, they may come back, so that's only used in certain situations. It can be done, again, with laparoscopic surgery, with or without the robot, and it can be done with open procedures. And sometimes, again, some of the laparoscopic surgeries, they make a lot of holes of an inch size versus some of the open procedures that can make one hole of a 2-inch size. So depending on your perspective, different operations may be indicated. And recurrence rates for fibroid regrowth after myomectomy are unfortunately very high, about 50%.
Let's go next to Joan in Champaign. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'm interested in the other end of the spectrum, that is people between the ages of, let's say, 80 and 85, and what might they need to continue in terms of checkups. And then I have a more specific question, and that is that 30 years ago, you performed surgery on me for endometrial cancer. Everything's been beautiful since then, but I keep being told by the folks who do who had been doing my mammograms that because of that endometrial cancer back then, I need to have a mammogram every year. What do you think?
So,
in general, not specific.
So, when to stop those mammograms is definitely a question. And whether or not you need them every year or every couple, 3 years, that would be the secondary question. Whether or not people who have endometrial cancer are in general more of a high estrogen state, which would make them generally more at risk for breast cancers. But women, the biggest factor in breast cancer risk is age.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you get into your 80s, that your risk probably can't go any higher, no matter what your history was. So I still, if somebody's young and active and calling the radio, I'm figuring she's young and active still, I would say probably continuing mammograms is good.
Okay.
You know, at some point, we're going to all have to step back and evaluate how much radiation we are exposed
exactly.
to in general. And that's where that piece is going to change a little bit. In terms of the types of things gynecologically for checkups for women in their 80s, this is going to change. It depends on whether people are sexually active. It depends on your bladder symptoms. It depends on your history. Some people will still need pelvic exams to check their ovaries. Some people will need pelvic ultrasounds. Some people need PAPs. I don't know that we can give you a short answer there.
So in other words, those of us who are in our 80s really do need to maintain a relationship with a physician, hopefully an OBGYN.
I think some healthcare provider that you know chooses to practice that type of medicine mm-hmm. can give you great guidance.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. And that's where we will have to wrap things up.
Well, thank you. I'll see you again
in a few months.
And we'll talk more about some of the topics we didn't get to in depth.
Dr. Suzanne Troop, an obstetrician and gynecologist with Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She's also a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois. Dr. Troop, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu. On tomorrow's show, the truth is out there, or rather it's right here on Focus, where we will talk with Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files. Tens of millions of viewers were captivated by the television series The X-Files back in the 1990s. The show was part anthology series, part elaborately plotted conspiracy. Each week, agents Mulder and Scully would seek to unravel an ever more complex and dangerous conspiracy involving extraterrestrials and sinister, shady characters. The program resonated in particular with conspiracy theorists as well as with viewers who just saw it as rip-roaring fiction. We will talk with Chris Carter about what inspired the show and why he thinks it became such a hit. We'll also talk about a character he featured, which was named after University of Illinois professor Mae Birenbaum. That episode in which that character appears will be screened as part of this year's Insect Fear Film Festival on campus. That's Chris Carter on Focus tomorrow. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.